Hi, I'm Anna Harris, and this is the Defined by God podcast, a support resource for Christians looking for hope and healing from trauma and adversity. Join us as we interview experts, hear stories of healing from real people, and discuss and define common types of trauma, how it impacts us, and the latest and best strategies for healing and thriving. Hi, I'm Anna Harris. Thank you so much for joining us for the podcast today. I'm very excited to introduce you to my guest today. His name is John Archambault. Hope that I said that right. And he is a retired corporal from the Canadian military, Canadian Armed Forces. He served more than 11 years there. And 6 years in law enforcement. And now he helps people. One of the things that he does is helps people that are in recovery from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And he himself is in recovery, and he's learned a lot about it, and is now turning around and helping other people who are also recovering. So I'll let him tell you more about his story, and I will bring John on now.
Hi.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Good yourself.
Yes, great. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I've heard a little of your story, and I've also read some of your book, Operation Wired Differently, which I'll put a picture up of that in a bit. But so your story is pretty fascinating, and also just how you're really being so intentional about your own recovery from PTSD and also helping other people. Would you just give people, you know, just a bit of background to get started with?
Sure, sure. So you told me 10 minutes. I'm going to do my best for 10 minutes of my life. But so I'm from the French part of Canada. This is where the accent is coming from. My parents are both intellectual people, psychologist background. So I was raised with that kind of help and serving people constantly. My dad is on the has been helping men who has tendency to be violent and towards their family member for all his life. And my mother helped young girls who've been raped or assaulted by their family member. So I've been raised in that kind of really helping people. And I think if it would have been in a perfect world for them, I would have ended up as well as a psychologist. So as a young kid, I went to church. I mean, I was singing every Sundays and so on and so forth. As I grew, my parents kept me in private school, and it's going to be important for down the road. I will explain why. But at 17 years old, I was done high school. I was kind of completed my first year of college, and I was not challenged. So I strapped my boots on and I wanted to learn English. And the reason why I'm saying this is the part where I'm from of Canada is French only. At that time, if you walk into a store and speak English, most of people will not answer you because they don't speak English. My parents never learned English, and as of today, still don't speak it, but speak multiple other language. There's that historical rivalry between French and English in Canada, and it was really prominent when I was a kid. So I learned Spanish at the age of 5 years old, and I wanted to learn English because all I've heard in school is English people are bad, which I needed to have proof, I guess, to really confirm if it's true. So I move across the country into the Rockies, just above Montana, and I wanted to learn English. Now, there was more French people there, so I did not really learn, but seeing the world, I mean, our country was already great, opening my eyes and so on and so forth. A little bit later, I moved to Brazil to study in Porto Alegre, which is the third biggest city in Brazil, and then learned Portuguese. My English got a bit better with the time. And upon my return, I realized that my university was not recognized in Canada. So I walked in front of a recruitment center for the military, and I walked in. My parents were totally against the military because it's not the French part of Canada. It was the country itself. But despite everything there, I signed up for it. They said that I was going to be a translator since I spoke three languages and I could learn English eventually and so on and so forth. So sign up a month later, I'm in my boot camp. where even when I said that rivalry was very present, there was either a French platoon or an English platoon. And at the end, the exercise we had was the French against the English, right? So kind of we're going back into the 1700, 1800, where you did that rivalry is still very present. And my first posting was in English Canada, so Ontario. And then I just stayed since then in that English side of the things. So life has been good. I was very active. I was very present in doing whatever I could do in my trade, which at that time was in the communication. A bit later, I switched into the logistics side of the things, where I was posted in a Navy unit, and I was the only Army member within the unit. After a year of working there, one of the commander of a ship put me in his office, and he's like, "Son, we're going to talk." And I was like, what's going on? He's like, "You're a bit too hyper for a unit here, and not so useful, right? Like, you're done your job after 2 hours of the day, and then you just sit around. It doesn't look good." So he's like, he's pointing to a frame at the back. It looks like this. And he's like, "Do you know what that is?" And I had no clue, right? I had never been raised being aware of the military, and Canada is not as patriotic as U.S. is. And I've got to say, we're sometimes better treated in U.S. than we are in Canada as veterans, right? So it's important to say, and I'm really thankful for it. So he's like, "This is Special Force." And he's like, "If you want to apply, you're going to have, I will back you up for it." So I started the paperwork and so on and so forth. Roughly 9 months later, after doing all the tests, I was selected and I was in as a supporter role, where worked into operational and so on and so forth. And I got deployed in Iraq. Upon my return of Iraq, I wanted to be even more, I wanted to serve more, but directly to the community, right? Not that there's nothing wrong with the military, but I was in a secret place, so nobody knew what we were doing. I couldn't speak about it. We had our little crew and couldn't really be open about what's going on. Our spouse knew somewhat, but we did not expend too much for safety reason. So I applied for the police, and I applied for the federal police at first. Contrary to what you guys have, we have like the Mounties, and the Mounties can be federal police, but it can also be city police. So they're spread out a bit everywhere in Canada, and I wanted to go there. So after 8-9 months of waiting, and there's nothing going on, right? There's just a wait. I applied to a city police, again, across the country, above Montana. And within 2 months, I was selected. So I was selected as a foreign language person, which is kind of funny because it's the second language of Canada. But so I got selected. 6 months later, I got my release from the military. They allowed me to go and started my career into the policing life. I loved it. I love serving people. I love being there, but it was not what I expected. I was kind of sad of the culture. I thought it was a brotherhood, sisterhood, community, however we're going to call it. And it turned out to be, it's not reactive. We're not acting upon crime that is happening, as we're just reactive after the fact, right? So I was a bit sad about it. And I mean, I had been into that operational kind of world for 5 years prior to that in Special Force. Then the policing was a different beat, right? And it was on shift. We had a little one, meanwhile, at that time. And 2 months later, after he's born, we're flying to Florida because my wife and I deserve a little break. Our in-laws are down there. And we want to just go chase some dolphins and not some mooses. So fly down there. Everything goes well. And one day I'm unpacking in, in Naples, Florida. And I cannot move. I don't know why, what's going on, but I cannot move. And my wife turns around after stopping chasing some dolphins. And she said, "What's going on, John?" And I'm like, I can't move. I actually don't know what's going on. And I had that surge of like stress, anxiety, but as well as not being in control of what's going on for me. So she dragged me back to shore, and I got to our room because it was a 2-bedroom condo. My in-laws were in the other one and we were in that one. And I did not get out for the last 2 days of the trip.
So, and when you say you couldn't move, you mean like physically you couldn't move?
Physically, I was full of fear. I was tense. I couldn't explain what was going on. Yeah. So the first thing I did when I got to the room is I called the VA. And I was like, can I have help? And the reason why I didn't call the police service is because I didn't want to lose my job, right? Because we all know that someone has mental issues. There's a lot of stigma around it. They would take my gun. They would take my badge. And then I have no job. And I just dropped all that service that I did in the military to do this, right? Like, it's, I moved my entire family 4,000 kilometers away, which is 2,600 miles for you guys. So it was a lot of things. So I got a meeting as soon as I flew back home, I got a first meeting with a social worker, and she's like, oh, it's just adaptation disorder. A lot of military leave. The transition is very hard because in the military, you're such a frame life. Then what happened when you get into civilian life is you're like thrown in the middle of the jungle without a map, and you don't know where to go, right? Because there's no frame really, or there's a frame, but it's not the same. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm not crazy. I'm okay. I'm just going to keep pushing through. And a year later, I had another dip like this, where I got told by, I think it was a lawyer before preparing for one of the case that I was bringing, charged someone. She's like, we don't give, and her word was, we don't give a shit about what you did in the military. You're not a specialist. And I was like, well, but I did stuff that, yeah, you don't have university. We don't recognize this. I was really thrown off. And after that meeting we had, I went down back to my patrol car and I sat and I put my sunglasses and it just started to flow. And I was like, well, but what's going on? And then breathing heavily. And I'm like, I've been in Iraq. I've been through training. I've been through fights and as a police officer where it did not turn so well for me, so on and so forth. And I'm like, why am I so afraid of what's going on? I could not understand. And one of the things that I've been taught by family members because of their employment is like, you need to really dig into what's you're going through because it's internally. So I was trying to see, but help was not, I was not finding the answer. So help had to be found, right? So I messaged my sergeant via my computer in the car and I said, we got to meet. And he's like, perfect, because I want to talk to you. Usually when your boss want to talk to you, it's not a good thing, right? Yeah. So I sat down and he's like, you're not so happy anymore. What's going on? You're not the guy who's making jokes, because French people are usually smaller than English people. So I'm a smaller guy. And usually when I enter a crisis call, I would be like, French police is here. Hello. And people will start laughing. And then I can talk, right? Like, I have their attention. So
right.
I always played with humor because that's, I'd rather speak than having to resolve to like force. So all that to say, I said, well, I was panicking and I said, I cannot do it. I can't do it anymore. And I forgot one point. 1 month prior to this one, I attended a suicide, and I had a lot of suicide calls. I mean, I call myself a black sheep for having seen so many dead body in a short time that I did policing. And it was a veteran. He had opened his two wrists, inner ties. It was probably 3 liters of blood in the mattress, soaked up. And usually when you have someone with a knife, you don't enter the house alone because it's for safety, right? Right. And at that point, I had not seen those signs, but I wouldn't care about my own life. I would just walk in, do my stuff, and try to help him as much as I can. When a firefighter and the paramedic showed up, I was able to look around the room and then realize, okay, where's the correctional officer? Okay, well, that's one of us. So I call my boss and I'm like, he's one of us. We got to do something. It's not normal, right? We got to take care of this man. I mean, he's a first responder. And then I move his uniform and I hung up and I saw he had ribbons. So he had been in Bosnia. He has been in a few UN tours. And I was like, wait, he's one of me now, right? He's one of my peers. And I call him back and I'm like, he's a veteran, blah, blah, blah. He's like, well, you're a veteran. We don't give a shit. He's not a cop from our service. And I was like, and that kind of threw me off, but it took a little while. I did not explode right away or had any reaction. I think I was a lot more jaded than I thought as well by seeing things. So like that month later, I think that's kind of where the ball in my throat of feelings came out. And I never got back. I went home. He gave me one day. And I was not able to find a doctor at that time. I asked for a second day and a third day, which was a night shift. And he's like, you know what? It's all good. Get a doctor. Talk to your doctor. We'll figure a plan. Monday followed up. And I was sitting in front of my doctor, who's a veteran from UK. And he's like, well, son, he had a little little smile because my wife had to explain everything because I was crying like a baby again and I couldn't understand what was going on. He's like, well, you got PTSD, son. And I was like, all right, good. I never questioned myself, why did I sleep 2 hours a night? Because everyone around me had that. But there's a lot of signs and red flag that happened in my life throughout that I should have, you know, pay attention. Like that risk factor of jumping and entering place where it's dangerous, alone, not caring for my own life. Like those little things, I gained an amount of weight that was pretty large when I left the military, like roughly 40 pounds. And I was like, I just probably night shift, right? And there must be something. I even had a panel with my blood done, tested, because I thought something off. And truthfully, it was all mental. So that's when the recovery or, you know, jumping into all of this kind of started. And
so at that point, when the doctor said that, that was that really the first time you really realized what was going on with you?
Yes.
That was PTSD.
So my mind was, you know, I was being raised by two specialists of the mind. My strength is my mind, right? Like there's nothing else. This is what I'm strong at. And my thought that was kind of, there's people with big muscle. I guess my brain is my big muscle, right? You find every reason possible. I never drank a lot. Right, I partied because kind of part of culture in the military, but from the special force on, I would probably drink 4 times a year. Now, the 4 times a year, I would have 5 bottles of wines on my own, right? Mm-hmm. So I never counted as I'm an alcoholic because I'd never needed the booze. But what I needed is that big dump of dopamine constantly, right? Which is that we're looking at adrenaline dump, that we're looking at working out until it hurts. It has to very, very hurt. Getting into training training like firearms and so on and so forth, or fighting where the training happens, where, you know, it's the fear kicks in and then the relief, right? So I never thought that those were part of it ever. Mm-hmm. Because again, the people around me were geared the same way.
Right.
Now, what I found later on is roughly 70 to 78% of people in special force have PTSD. Mm. We just don't talk
makes
about
sense.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So now is the quest of finding the right psychologist. Mm-hmm. Right. And I knew I had to prove to the insurance of the police that I'm doing my deeds and I'm sitting weekly. So I started, I think I went through 8 different psychologists, roughly. One, because I sort of fear in her eyes when I told one of my trauma, and she was like, okay. And I'm like, are you okay? I think we shouldn't see each other. She's like, why? And I'm like, your eyes went like big, like two dot, like big round golf ball. Right. And she's like, oh, I had a dust in my eye. I'm like, yeah, it doesn't work. That lie doesn't work here. So went to another one. The other one compare his NFL career, stress that he had with the military deployment. I was like, no, you're playing a sport. I'm playing war. It's not a play.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I was like, we cannot compare. And if you compare this to my life, we're gone. So it took a while to find the right one. And what it ended up in Canada, we have what we call OSI clinic, which is an operational stress injury. This is what the term used for first responder veterans military for PTSD.
Okay.
Which makes sense, right? Because it's an injury we developed when we were usually operational, versus the PTSD is more, it's generic, right? It's a general term. And some people did not like to have the disorder. To me, it doesn't matter. It's a term. And what we should focus is on to fix ourselves and get better, right? But so OSI clinics are made just for the federal police and the military. Which we have specialized psychiatrists, occupational therapists, all of those in the same place, one stop. So it was kind of good for this. So I was accepted there and finally got one who started everything from the CBTI to EMDR, where we follow a green light, to ART, to I had a magnetic shock on my brain for 6 weeks, every day for 18 minutes. Was told that I'm an anomaly, first person that did not work in 17 years. So there's a lot of things, but with time, what I discovered is my parents had, you know, taught me how to do the deep breathing, right? Which is a grounding effect. And it kind of, I won't say abuse, but it was used for small things. So now I had like a big amount of trauma. So those were not effective. With time, I find my own way of grounding myself, i.e. going in nature. We have snow here. It's cold right now. I would plant my 2 feet in the snow for a good 3 minutes where I will just come back to the present, and so on and so forth. So it's been 4 years in recovery now. It's a very interesting path. Let's go with this. But one thing I can say openly is I embrace way more the person I become, became, versus the person I used to be. I think I had been a part where I was so numb. I mean, there's a time during Christmas where my son was opening his gift. And I mean, a 2 years old opening gift is beautiful. You should have a smile. And I had nothing. I was feeling actually nada, nothing. And I looked around, look at my wife, my in-laws, and I'm like, okay, they're smiling. I got to smile now. That's kind of all the cues I would follow because it was dead, right? And then not dead, but it was more, is numbed out because it was so in pain. The other thing I had to face is dissociation. So there's various way of doing dissociation. And in my case, as I would zone out. So my wife could walk, see me on the couch, and I sit at that place for 2 hours without any reaction. Right. Or my son, I was a meter away because I was home. We hoped to save a bit of money on daycare. And he was behind me playing with a safe gate and it fell on it. And that's what I assume because I don't have any memories until the gate was on top of him. And at that time, obviously, we realized I cannot have any child around me because the therapy is so heavy that my brain needs a break. And what came with this is obviously paranoia, right? There was a side of paranoia that I had where, while I had been overseas, I had heard things. I had learned that the secrets that people don't know about where we live. Right. So I was not feeling safe in my own backyard. So I would start to track the vehicle in my backyard, track the vehicle that drive across the street, so on and so forth.
Yeah, so the hypervigilance that goes along with PTSD. Yeah,
exactly. And the same with when I was driving, if I had to drive to therapy, well, it's we're in kilometers, so I'm going to try to transfer that in miles. But let's say it's 40 miles an hour. Well, I would drive 80 miles an hour.
Yeah,
because someone who follows me at 80 miles, I can see it, no problem, right? And not caring again for life, being risky and so forth. Those signs were very big. So when COVID kicked, I didn't mind. I was in my home. I didn't want to get out of it, right? Like I was staying here. So what were you talking about? This is awful. I'm like, it's not awful. I'm in my basement. I have my firearms. I'm totally safe. When truthfully later on, I realized how it affected population, especially when I saw my child, right? But in my own case, I did not see at first how it could affect my own life. So with the time, it kind of grew. We had a lot of trial, we talked about, you know, ADHD, you and I before, and during my recovery time, I was diagnosed with ADHD as well.
And I'll just make a note for people listening that we're going to have a part two and we're going to talk about ADHD and similarities to PTSD and all of that. So stay tuned for the next episode also.
And it's exactly what you just said. There's so many links to each other. It's insane. So as a good kid, kid of 35 years old being told, you have ADHD. And I was like, I thought that ADHD was for kids, right? Because usually it can become as well for adults as bipolar quite often. So ADHD adult is not something that is learned or heard often and so on and so forth. You hear a lot of women being diagnosed with ADHD in the 30s to 40s or 43. But men usually transfer to something else. So call my father. And I was like, I learned that I have ADHD. He's like, I know. And I was like, and he is so nonchalant about it. I was like, well, what do you mean, you know? He's like, well, what do you think we sent you to private school? They have a good frame there. And that's what you need for ADHD person. Instead of sending you in every sport possible, we didn't have the money to, you know, pay for hockey, pay for football, pay for all of those. We sent you to private school. They had such a frame and you love school. So at school, they never saw that I had an issue because I call myself a forever student. I love learning. Mm-hmm. So whatever I can put my paws on, I will try to learn, read, and so on and so forth. So while at recovery, that's what I did as well for PTSD, ADHD. I started to buy books. And, right. and as much as my memory was really failing me, I was taking notes on everything. I have books and notebooks. I mean, you walk around my house, my wife has stickers, notes on the house just so I don't forget things. Our meetings, the good example is last Monday where I had like alarm on my phone, alarm on my calendar. And that's the failing part of one ADHD, but PTSD as well. They kind of come together in both cases. Mm-hmm. So
what's been the best for you and that maybe people listening could translate to their own situation that has helped you in your recovery? What are the best like tools and things?
Accepting that we have to go through it. Mm. So for people, let's say that serve, let's put it with the military, we're trained to fight.
Right.
So that's the first mistake, right? It's okay to fight to live. And I think there's a big difference there. It's okay to fight to live, right? To live better, but don't fight PTSD. It's there. Right.
Yeah.
You got a diagnosis. It's done now. Right. Like let's walk with it and not against it. So I learned with a lot of failure, and that's the biggest thing that I learned in the military is get up. If you fail five times, get up six times. It doesn't matter. At first I joined the peer support groups, which was great to be in a room where people can understand me without mm-hmm. talking. Right. And I learned kind of, oh, this medication does side effect. Oh, you're saying that my leg shake at night for no reason? That's good of the medication. Perfect. Great. Okay. Have you tried this one for sleeping? No. Okay. Well, I tried it. I kicked my wife three times in my sleep. She doesn't like it. To each their own. But there was a negative to it. I would come back home and I would be angry that my wife don't understand a thing. So the communication between me and her went really south. Mm. Right. So learn, and there's balance on everything, right? I need to speak here as same as peer support is good. So I started to advocate for those things, like what the mistakes I did or why I realized that kind of was negative or positive. I started to talk around and reach out to people. And since COVID was in this bloom part of life, internet was the big thing. And I started to write. So I write like little poems. So I write some story that I went through it. And I started to push it to friends. And my friends are like, why don't you write a book? So I kind of went through, and the book is a reflects not war story, not policing story. This is not, there's millions of those kind of books. What I wanted to show is how does it affect a life? Mm-hmm. Sometimes hypervigilance is so prominent without you knowing, right? Things are better nowadays. I'm not going to lie. It's easier for me to go to grocery per se, right? I'm not going to Costco because there's so many people. Mm-hmm. And Costco is crazy. But I select my things. I'm still in the works to get there. I did speech engagement with people, and that's okay. Right? I have no problem. But there's still some stuff where there's work, and that's there's stuff that I will never be able to do again, which mm-hmm. is okay. So I think there's a point in life where we have to make peace. Where okay, well, life brought us here, and either I accept it or I stay here, and I should not be there. Right? The sign of life is saying keep on going because there's something even better that's going to come down the road. Yeah. So that the book brought that, right? And it's a very angry book. I mean, you're reading it right now. I'm very angry and I'm hurt and so on and so forth because I can tell you I don't remember the book. Mm-hmm. That's another side effect of the things, right? I have someone who read, sent me a little video earlier today and she's like, what do you think about this? I'm like, it's very well written. She's like, it's your book. And I was like, no, it's not. And I wrote it in English too, right? So yeah. I've been in the English world for so long that my writing skills in French has been down. Mm-hmm. My wife doesn't speak French either. So it's been English for a while, but, and there's probably a turn in my word sometime in the book that is French, right? And there's a part where I swear it's all French. And actually it's church words, right? So for the Quebec side, the Canadian French, part of Canada, because the church was so prominent in the 1950s to the 1970s, to make a lot of kids and they were very into the politics aspect of the things, that mm-hmm. the swear words in French are items in the church.
Yeah.
The tabernacle is a swear, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, right? Like those are the F words that we use back home, mm-hmm. which is interesting. I think it's cultural, but it's an interesting part as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so with time, I like learning about what's going on in our own body is extremely important, right?
Right.
If someone has with diabetes should learn about diabetes to make the mm-hmm. best choice, right? And so on and so forth. So I respect more my limits too. And that's something I learned with time, because I thought that limits were just something that we can push further.
Right.
And advocating for PTSD. So it's not such a big stigma, right? There's, mm-hmm. I ask a few people at times, and I go to stores here at the beginning. And when I was sick, and I was like, what do you think about PTSD? Oh, wow, that's a military person who has a gun and shoot people.
Hmm.
And I was like, I'm hiding in my basement. I'm not about to shoot anyone. I'm afraid of people. So I wanted to kind of switch as well the mentality that we have, because sadly, the media is a big influence, right, in the world. Mm-hmm. And if the media or Hollywood shows, and by Hollywood, I just mean movies, shows that, you know, veterans get angry, take guns and make crimes. And it did happen. I'm not going to remove that, but there's probably a handful of it.
Right. Percentage wise. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it happens here as well. And it's very sad. And what I see in this is someone who's extremely hurt. Right. Mm-hmm. And it gets to an extreme, same as a suicide, right? The suicide is another thing, because during my recovery, I remember clear, like it was clear as day, I was beside the Trans-Canadian, which is a street, the highway that goes coast to coast. And I was wondering, okay, like how fast do I have to run in front of a big truck so I don't feel pain ever again? Mm. I didn't want to end my life. I just didn't want the pain. And right. I think there's another misconception here where people are saying suicide is for, you know, people who are just walking away. And it's not it. It's if we're used to, let's say, a horrible pain for 2 days and it's been 2 weeks, we want it to stop. Stop, right. Please. I want a break in my head. And that made me realize that thing as well, right? So I went through it, and I came back for my wife and my kids, because I did not want them to have no father or no husband, right? She didn't deserve any of this. But I've had a friend who just committed suicide a few months ago, and his wife was telling me, because I got in touch with her, and she's like, you know, he was telling me that he would never make that coward move. And I'm like, it is not a coward move. It's just someone who wants to tune out the pain. And it's hard to actually explain it, but it's hard to understand when you have not been in that process or that train of thought. So this is the little things I wanted to raise awareness. While doing the book, I needed to do self-publicity, because I decided to do to publish my own book.
Mm-hmm.
Self-published, sorry. Because I didn't want anyone to change my words, right? A lot of traditional publicists mm-hmm. will make up. I won't say, are we going to say it that way? Well, I don't want to change it. This is my book. I decide how it goes and so on and so forth. And I wanted to see how things go. Yes.
I'm putting up a picture of your book. There you go.
And the man on the book actually is, his name is Chris Williams. He's a member who served. And it was, I think it was 5 degrees that day outside in the water. And his face is really like, oh my God, it's freezing in that water.
Oh my gosh.
So anyway, so that's a small story, but it's what I discovered with this is there's a community of people who suffer, and mm-hmm. it's easier to go through not alone. Easier to go through with support of each other. But the most beautiful thing, and I realized that I would say roughly 2 months ago, so it really, really changed. It's a mindset. We can have the best team of specialists. I can have the best wife or spouse, best kids ever. And they're not the best right now. They're in the monster stage. But if we don't have the mindset of I'm going to feel better tomorrow, and there will be awful days, but there will be more better days than bad. Mm-hmm. It's not happening. And I it took me a long time, and it was one of my friend who came to me, and he's like, you know, John, he's like, you can heal from everything. Sadly, you can, as long as you really want to. and I have a lot of respect and love for this man. And I was like, all right, I'm going to heal. And it's in the last 2 months, life change. But if we want to talk about the coaching and so on and so forth, because we met in a class, you and I,
right.
And 6 months, 8 months prior to this, my wife came home and I was, it was my second year of recovery. And she's like, well, we both know you're not going back there. So let's find you a job. And I was like, and what? And she's like, well, about.
Because you had left policing back when you got diagnosed with PTSD. Is that right?
No. So I was still under the policing aspect.
Okay.
And the police insurance, if you wish, right? So okay. I had been told you will never go back. You're permanently restricted to wear a uniform. That's how they call it in the, I guess, insurance term. But they said you will eventually be able to work. And there's a lot of stressor in this, right? Because insurance, their goal is to get you back.
Yes.
Right. Cool. And I'm not going to discard the fact that if they get me back, they don't have to pay me. Right. So that $5,000 salary, it goes back to whoever may be. So they push and they push hard. At one point, and that happened last September, I said no more. So I removed myself from the police service. I transferred myself to the VA. So I dropped salary of roughly $45,000, but I'm dealing with people who understand what PTSD is.
Right.
Okay. So I have better respect there. I've been followed before by, and that's not my paranoia. So insurance claim, right? They will actually follow you to make sure you're not fraud. Right. And had that. Now you're following a police officer and ex-military. And I'm going to see it. And I live in a town of 30,000 people. So it's a pretty small town. If there's an odd car, you figure it out. Mm-hmm. So with the VA, they're just like, okay, well, it's going to take the time it's going to take. And we're going to pay you this because that was a salary in the military. And you're going to carry on. So I did a transfer. But my wife came up home and she's like, you know, you have a good intake on people. You read them well and you love caring for them. And what about coaching? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is coaching? I have my coaching certificate for personal trainer. What are you talking about? And she's like, no. I mean, coaching as like life coach. And I was like, this is a woo-woo stuff that they're talking about in the US, right? And because it was not here yet, right? So, or it was creeping in, but not so strongly. Mm-hmm. She's like, yeah, I have that Brooke Castillo. She has a school. And I was like, who's that? And she's like, listen to her podcast. And it's a very empowering woman podcast that it was. And I'm like, I don't care being that odd person who's a man in that case. So I'll sign up for it. She's like, I'll see you in this. Okay.
Wow.
So I signed up for it that night. Never looked at the price. To turn out, it was $28,000 for 6 months.
Wow.
That I had a bit more problem to digest. But what it did actually is helped me a lot in my recovery. Because what I had not digest in the past was dealt with in therapy. What I had problem is living in the present moment. And that's what life coach is quite about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they brought me in the present. I sat with multiple coach and obviously I kind of brought up some of my traumas where it was fantastic for them because it was a case study. It was fantastic for me because it was helping me going forward. So I went on with this and obviously I was not allowed to make money because when you're on long-term disability, that would be fraud. So, so I just tried to help people that I had around me and I enjoyed it. Interestingly enough, obviously more uniform people, but I also had those overachiever that came to me where, you know, they're career people oriented and they're like, okay, well, I wonder, that doesn't work. And I was like, okay, well, how's your life going? Right. And then to realize that it's not the work that was not wrong for them. It's there's something in their personal life that was not so great, or they had to shift a bit, or why my son is such a kerfuffle of energy, right? Well, he must have ADHD. Get him on the pills. Well, maybe if you spend time with your son or like sit down on the ground 45 minutes a day, it will change. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, because he's acting up because you're not looking. You're not, you know, giving attention. And sometimes that's all we need, right? A third perspective to look into our life and say, well, it's right there.
Right.
Right. So I help friends like this. I help some of the people I serve with, some CEOs, some VPs. And there's something great in this because it's still helping, right? So it's still serving people. Right. I created a program called You're Not Your Diagnosis as well. And it was not just for PTSD, but it was for, you know, neurodivergent, because again, we have a stigma towards the ADHD. We have a stigma towards autism, right? Back in the 90s, well, it was the ADD until they realized, well, that's not the proper term. We're going to call it ADHD or so on and so forth. And most people just think it's hyperactivity, right? Like, oh, yeah, for them to concentrate. Well, no, like, I mean, there's the rejection sensitive dysphoria. That's when you reject yourself before anyone rejects you because you're afraid that they're going to reject you. Does that make sense, right? It's insane. But I was like, okay, that's interesting. I need to read about this. So now I bought more books. And my wife's like, stop with Amazon. We're having package every day. I'm like, well, I don't get out. So they're coming here. And but one of the biggest thing was to learn about who I am. And as the things went on is... what type of personality also do I have that comes with, you know, those diagnoses? How am I going to manage that? And what I realized for the longest time is I was someone who just want to please people because I did not love myself enough, right? And again, it sounds woo-woo a bit, but I think that before we love anyone outside of us, we need to love ourselves. Before we respect anyone outside of our circle, we need to respect us and trust. We need to trust our decision.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So those things are very basic.
This might be a good place for us to come to a close for this part. And we'll continue in part two, because I know people are going to be interested in what you are going to talk about with the ADHD as well. Sure. And like you mentioned, so we had met in the trauma and resiliency coaching program. I don't know how you found out about it, but I think it was a great training. I was really, really happy about it.
Yeah, it was really well done. Actually, I have a friend who's a dispatcher who had been diagnosed with PTSD. And she's like, John, do you know about the Arizona Trauma Institute? My first question was like, do they pay for us to go there? because the Veterans Affairs here, the VA, give us, if you did more than 7 years, they give us $45,000 for any schooling we want to do. And if you did more than 12 years, they give us $85,000 or $89,000. Yeah. But we don't have all the discount and so on that your military has and so on. So, I mean, it's a balance, right? So she's like, I don't know. So I called and I kind of looked. And the prices are fairly good. So I was like, okay. I signed up for 7 of them right off. And one of them was a trauma resiliency. And obviously when we started, we were, I think, 36 person in the class. And I'm like, that's a pretty big class to deal with. Because if we all have, I had the kind of same setup in my mind of the course I had done, where everyone is coaching someone at every course.
Right.
I'm like, 35 person coaching, it's going to be a long course. They're going to be a lot of blah, blah in that course for sure. But you're right. It was actually very interesting to see a psychologist giving his opinion on how things are run. And maybe they should not be run in such way. The serotogenic approach is such a fantastic approach. And I've seen the both. And I can tell you that the old ways, I went through it and I never been so close and shut off to, I would not open, and I'm a pretty open person, as you can tell. I talk nonstop.
Just so our listeners will know, or viewers will know, the salutogenic approach basically is finding someone's strengths that they have and encouraging them. And it's really dealing with the whole person and wholeness rather than disease oriented, finding out what's wrong with someone and let's fix that thing that's wrong. Exactly. So I think it's a really great approach. So, okay. Thank you so much. We're going to close here and we will be back next time with part two, which is we're going to go further into the similarities and differences in PTSD and ADHD. And, you know, they're both such interesting topics that I know you'll all want to see that. So thank you so much, John.
And thanks to you.
I'm going to put in the notes, I'll put where people can find you too with your website and your book.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us for the Defined by God podcast. If you'd like more information, please visit our website at definedbygod.com and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and email list.